and in his case, to be sent to a place where he's free, will have emotional, psychological support and connection to his family.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting application for a director of finance administration, also human resources manager. Check it out at democracynow.org. And stay with us throughout these 2 weeks. Democracy Now! Is your place for the UN Climate Summit and everywhere around the world. I'm Amy Goodman.
À la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Did you miss the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/ACR to listen to the archived show. You can also snag a limited edition KBOO Afro-Caribbean and Reggae hoodie before November 20th to show your support for the music and the programming you love. Again, you can catch the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon and snag a limited edition hoodie at kboo.fm/ACR.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a web and new media coordinator. Our web and new media coordinator is responsible for KBOO's website and social media accounts. Applicants should have experience administering a CMS such as Drupal and experience administering a MySQL database, including backups and queries. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due by November 17th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland and Multnomah County officials announce a $38 million package to address houseless issues. Unions file a complaint after Oregon news outlets receive employee vaccination records. And Election Day is tomorrow in Oregon. Special election ballots must be returned to an official site by 8 p.m. Tuesday. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 1st, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Election ballots in Oregon's November 2nd, 2021 special election are due back to county election offices or official drop boxes by 8 p.m. tomorrow, November 2nd. Postmarks do not count in Oregon's vote-by-mail system, so it's too late to mail in your ballot. Ballots must be dropped off at county elections offices or official drop boxes. Issues on the special election ballot will vary depending on where you live, and only some communities in Oregon are holding elections. In Multnomah County, the November 2nd election will have impacts for the cities of Fairview and Lake Oswego, the Lake Oswego School District, and the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue District. In total, that's about 12,000 voters. In addition, voters in Estacada will decide on a marijuana tax. There are also various school board and city council races on the ballot. Election ballots are due back by 8 p.m. tomorrow, November 2nd, and can no longer be mailed in. Ballots must be dropped off at county elections offices or official drop boxes. Portland and Multnomah County leaders announced on Monday a $38 million investment into houseless programs and public health services. The investments will go toward more shelter beds, behavioral health services, outreach workers, and community cleanup initiatives. Officials said the program will be funded in large part by the city's multi-million dollar fall budget surplus. Mayor Ted Wheeler, County Chair Deborah Cafori, and City Commissioner Dan Ryan explained the details of the spending package at a press conference on Monday. Cafori said, quote, "This represents a rare opportunity for us to come together, pool our resources, and inject an immediate infusion into our system to address homelessness in our community." Officials said the investment is also meant to target some of the city's high-impact areas, like the Old Town Chinatown neighborhood. The city and county will split the funding nearly evenly, with Portland receiving about $18 million and Multnomah County receiving roughly $19 million. A fraction of the total, $7 million, will be dedicated to expanding trash pickup and campsite cleanup programs. Oregon reported far fewer coronavirus cases in the week ending Sunday, adding about 7,500 cases, down 14.1% from the previous week. Across the state, cases fell in 30 counties, with the best declines in Lane, Washington, and Linn counties. Oregon ranked 18th among states in the share of people receiving at least one COVID shot, with 68.3% of residents at least partially vaccinated. The national rate is currently 66.5%. In the week ending Friday, Oregon reported administering another 105,531 vaccine doses, including 17,000 first doses. In the previous week, the state administered 76,000 vaccine doses. In all, Oregon reported it has administered more than 5.6 million total doses of a coronavirus vaccine. Weekly case counts rose in five counties from the previous week. The worst increases from the prior week's pace were in Yamhill, Sherman, and Wasco counties. Adding the most new cases overall were Multnomah, Marion, and Deschutes counties. In Oregon, 88 people were reported dead of COVID in the week that ended on Sunday. In the week before that, 123 people were reported dead of the disease. At least 365,000 people in Oregon have tested positive for the coronavirus since the pandemic began, and more than 4,300 people have died. Nationally, 45.9 million have tested positive for COVID, and more than 745,000 people have died. Five state employee unions have filed complaints against the state for disclosing vaccination status to the media. The complaints are against Oregon's Department of Administrative Services Labor Relations Unit, and the unions argue that the state violated the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act when it disclosed individual vaccination statuses to two news outlets. The unions say the information was released to the Oregonian and the Statesman Journal, and it included private medical information of more than 43,000 executive branch employees. Of those employees, more than 31,000 are represented by unions that filed the complaint. The five unions that filed the complaints are the Association of Engineering Employees of Oregon, the Service Employees International Union Local 503, the International Association of Firefighters Local 3340, and two Oregon American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employee Units. The unions are asking the state to pay each employee a civil penalty of $1,000 for violating the agreement. They also argue that the state should provide employees with any financial assistance needed if their personal information is disclosed and results in identity theft. The complaints say the Oregonian and the Statesman Journal have been receiving information regularly from the state reflecting the number of state employees that have received exemptions and accommodations related to the coronavirus vaccine. The problem is that the information that was sent out on October 18th included employees' names and their vaccination status, not just the aggregate numbers of how many state employees are vaccinated. The spreadsheet that was sent to the news outlets included whether specific employees were verified as vaccinated, whether they received a medical or religious exemption, whether their vaccination record or exemption request is still being processed, and if they hadn't submitted any information. So far, neither of the news outlets have published the individual's confidential and private information. The unions are also asking the state for a full apology for the so-called broken promises, and that they need to ensure that no additional data breaches occurred or will occur in the future. Hundreds of firefighters in New York City called in sick today as a COVID vaccine mandate for municipal employees goes into effect. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Hundreds of New York City firefighters called in sick on November 1st as a COVID-19 vaccine mandate for municipal employees went into effect. Normally, up to 1,000 firefighters call in sick on any given day, but the total number now is 2,300. Fire Department Commissioner Daniel Nigro said many calling in sick are doing so to protest a vaccination mandate. Nigro said if firefighters are not sick, he wants to see them back at work. Many unions connected to public safety have pushed back against the mandate. A Staten Island judge recently denied a police union request to block it. FDNY Firefighters Association President Andrew Ansborough said the firefighters' union is anti-mandate, not anti-vaccine. He believes many firefighters who were vaccinated over the weekend are taking sick days because of reactions. About 91% of municipal employees have received at least one dose of vaccine, including a large percentage of first responders. The New York City Police Department has an 84% vaccination rate, up from 70% when the vaccine mandate was announced on October 20th. The fire department has a 77% rate of vaccination, up from 58%. City officials have been worried about police and fire department shortages, though the mayor has said public safety is not compromised. The police department is making plans for potential shortages, including asking vaccinated officers to work overtime or to work double shifts. The fire department is planning for a potential 20% reduction in service, though no firehouses have, as of yet, been closed. Members of the police and fire departments had until 5 p.m. on October 29th to show proof they were vaccinated or they were placed on unpaid leave. FDNY Fire Officers Association President Jim McCarthy said personnel just want extra time to decide whether to get the vaccination, take an exemption, or retire. He said the previous policy of testing unvaccinated fire department members for COVID-19 was working, with a viral positivity rate of less than 0.5%. Fire department members protested outside the mayor's office on October 28th, with signs emblazoned with statements like "My Body, My Choice" and hashtag Natural Immunity. Mayor Bill de Blasio said 9,000 city employees are on leave without pay for not complying with vaccine regulations. He added people in fire departments or any other departments using sick leave inappropriately face very serious consequences, saying, quote, "When a city employee fakes it and puts other people's lives in danger, that's a serious thing," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The Biden administration's reconciliation bill includes union-friendly pro-act provisions. Eric Tegedoff has more on that with the Public News Service.
Unions could get a boost under provisions currently included in the budget reconciliation package. The Biden administration has released a revised proposal for its Build Back Better plan, which includes elements of the Protecting the Right to Organize, or PRO Act. Carissa Hahn is with the Communication Workers of America Union in Washington State. She says the PRO Act, including some of its provisions in the budget reconciliation package, will improve the organizing environment for workers in the workplace.
It will also do things like penalize unfair labor practices, and it really is going to tip the scales back in the favor of working people.
Hahn says the fear of retaliation for organizing a workplace is a major obstacle for forming unions. The PRO Act passed the House but has not received a vote in the Senate. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says the bill would undermine workers' rights and hurt the economy. But Dan Maurer with CWA thinks the expansion of employees' power could be good for business growth.
It's been harder and harder for workers to organize. So if we want to rebuild the labor movement and in turn rebuild the middle class, we've got to make sure that those issues get corrected.
In October, strikes took place in industries across the country. Hahn believes this is a response to how workers have been treated in recent years.
Especially with the COVID pandemic and the pressures that that has put on individuals at the job, that it's put on companies, that companies have passed down to the individual workers. I think that what we're seeing is a reckoning of sorts.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the People's Depot, a community-led independent bottle redemption service born out of the pandemic. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 56. Today in history, in 1512, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome is exhibited to the public for the first time. Michelangelo, one of the greatest Italian Renaissance artists, took several years to complete the epic ceiling frescoes. The quote of the day is from American entrepreneur, publisher, and advocate of Black-owned businesses, Earl G. Graves Sr., who said, quote, "Hold on to your dreams of a better life and stay committed to striving to realize it." Thank you. Florida's top Republican lawmakers want to pull the state out of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the nation's workplace safety agency. Governor Ron DeSantis wants legislators to explore the possibility in a November 15th special session. However, union groups argue that such a move would jeopardize the health and safety of millions of workers. Tramell Gomes has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Governor Ron DeSantis' newest battle with the Biden administration involves dropping Florida out of the nation's workplace safety agency, known as OSHA. In the governor's official call for a special session, he wants the state to evaluate whether it should assert jurisdiction over occupational safety and health issues for government and private employees. In other words, lawmakers will discuss whether the state should create its own agency to replace OSHA. But Teresa King with the Florida Building and Construction Trade Council says federal protections are life-saving for her industry and shouldn't be tampered with to win political points.
It would totally disrupt the safety mechanisms that are in place, that are known, that we have in the construction industry and with the clients that we work for when we go onto their property to work.
The controversy is an offshoot of Biden's call for OSHA to require employers with 100 or more workers to implement a COVID-19 vaccine or weekly testing mandate, but the proposal is still under review by the White House. Florida's special session is scheduled for November 15th to the 19th. According to OSHA, there are currently 22 state plans covering both private sector and state and local government workers. Rich Templin with Florida AFL-CIO, which represents over 1.3 million workers in the state, says Florida's history of eliminating its own Department of Labor some 20 years ago already reduced protections for public sector workers.
For the same state government to now say they want to pull everybody else in Florida out of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, that's terrifying because they've already shown that they have no interest and no commitment to put something in its place.
Templin says such a massive change should require all stakeholders to have a say in the process. Republican leaders contend Florida having its own agency could limit what they see as federal government overreach. However, any state worker safety plan must still get OSHA approval, a process that could take years beyond the current political fight. This is Tramell Gomes.
President Biden is leaving the Rome G20 summit and heading to Glasgow while his poll numbers are falling and a close election in the special election is predicted in Virginia. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
What we've seen again here in Rome, what I think is the power of America showing up and working with our allies and partners to make progress on issues that matter to all of us. And there's really no substitute for face-to-face discussions and negotiations.
President Joe Biden met with world leaders at the G20 summit in Rome this weekend. They discussed climate change, oil prices, labor shortages, and supply chain issues. The summit ended Sunday with the announcement of an agreement on less financing for coal projects, with the goal of containing global warming to an average of 1.5 degrees Celsius. At home, the president's approval ratings continue to sink. A new NBC poll says the majority of Americans now disapprove of Biden's job performance. The survey found that 7 in 10 adults, including almost half of Democrats, believe the nation is headed in the wrong direction. And a staggering 60% of adults view Biden's handling of the economy negatively, just 9 months into his presidency. Democrats are still working to fill in the details of their social and climate spending plan. The White House had hoped to unify the party by unveiling a new framework for the $1.75 trillion bill. But the votes of Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema still look insecure, with House votes planned as soon as Tuesday. Wall Street Journal congressional reporter Andrew Duren says despite the haggling, lawmakers appear to be nearing a finish line.
Democrats are operating with historically slim margins, even as they're trying to pass major pieces of legislation here in the next few weeks.
Virginians head to the polls tomorrow to elect their next governor, a post-Trump test for Democrats. University of Virginia political science professor Larry Sabato says the race between the Democrat, former Governor Terry McAuliffe, and Republican businessman Glenn Youngkin is expected to be close.
The state has been changing significantly in demographic terms and in regional terms. The most Democratic region of the state is Northern Virginia. And Northern Virginia, depending on how you define the region, is about a third of the entire statewide vote now.
Virginia had been reliably conservative until recently, but has elected only one Republican governor in the last 20 years. Finally, in COVID-19 news, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki tested positive for COVID-19 on Sunday. She's the highest-ranking Biden official to publicly disclose contracting the virus. Psaki said in a statement she has not had close contact with the president or senior members of the White House staff since the middle of last week. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A federal judge declines to halt a Wisconsin wolf hunt, and Google Doodle celebrates a late Zuni Pueblo weaver. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Friday, a federal judge declined to issue a new order to halt Wisconsin's wolf hunt, but it's still not clear whether the hunt will proceed this fall. Rob Mincer has more.
The state's wolf hunt, scheduled to begin next Saturday, was already on pause due to an injunction from a Dane County judge that has prevented the state from issuing permits. But in a separate case, 6 Ojibwe tribes asked a federal judge to block the hunt on the grounds that allowing it to proceed would do irreparable harm to the state's wolf population. And that judge decided not to make a ruling unless the state case is overturned on appeal. So far, state officials have declined to say whether they will appeal. In February, Wisconsin hunters killed 218 wolves in just 3 days, well in excess of the state's quota of 119. Gussie Lord is an attorney for Earth Justice. She says the, quote, botched February hunt has made it impossible to know how many wolves are left in Wisconsin.
There's just so many unknowns here that it's certainly our position that it's, you know, it's not time for another hunt in the same year, the first year the species is taken off the endangered species list.
Hunting advocates say a growing wolf population threatens livestock and pets. For National Native News, I'm Rob Mincer.
Tribes are opposing an advanced nuclear reactor proposal at the Hanford site in Washington, Eric Tigadoff reports.
The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation have sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Energy saying they don't support the company X Energy's small modular reactor proposal. Mason Murphy is Energy and Environmental Science Program Manager for the tribes. He says the Hanford Nuclear Reservation near the Columbia River is partially within tribally ceded territory under the Treaty of 1855.
Because of that, we anticipate that the small modular nuclear reactors may have impacts on all of the following resources, specifically state and federally listed plants and wildlife, big game habitat, historic properties of religious and cultural significance as defined in the National Historic Preservation Act.
X Energy's proposal involves advanced nuclear reactor technology that could produce more than 300 megawatts of power. The Department of Energy awarded the company $80 million in initial funding in 2020. The company says the technology is based on safe, clean, and affordable technology. The Hanford nuclear site was chosen during World War II to produce much of the country's plutonium for 40 years. That also meant a lot of waste, which is a concern for the tribes. Murphy says there's no solution for long-term storage of nuclear waste, some of which has half-lives of 15 million years. He worries what will happen if nuclear projects continue to be built there.
To me, that would indicate that they are likely to continue developing that nuclear mission, and those resources may never become available if that were the case.
Murphy says the Department of Energy has committed itself to pursuing environmental justice and should consider what that means in this situation.
Some of these larger cleanup sites like the Hanford site represent some of the largest environmental injustice sites. And I think that we need to really ensure that that's being taken into consideration when starting to site some of these technologies.
In 2007, the tribe's Board of Trustees adopted a policy that there should be no new nuclear energy production at the Hanford site without government-to-government consultation. Murphy says the Department of Energy has agreed to meet but has yet to set a date. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Google is kicking off Native American Heritage Month with an interactive doodle. The Google Doodle honors the late Zuni Pueblo weaver, potter, and fiber artist Wiwa. The late Wiwa was a revered cultural leader devoting their life to cultural preservation. Monday's Google Doodle celebrates the art of weaving. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Texas envoy to this week's COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, says federal and national business partnerships with local governments are critical in the fight to reverse climate change. Roz Brown has more with the Public News Service.
As climate scientists warn that time is running out to reverse the worst effects of climate change, some Texans will be among those looking for solutions at the Conference of Parties, or COP26, underway in Glasgow, Scotland. 30,000 people are expected to attend the annual summit, including heads of state, environmental activists, and business leaders. Travis County, Texas, will be represented by longtime County Commissioner Bridget Shea.
The national governments have to partner with local governments to really achieve the greenhouse gas reductions that have to happen in order to reverse climate change.
The 26th Climate Summit is considered the most important ever since a United Nations report declared a code red for humanity earlier this year. The summit continues through November 12th. Shea says 2017's Hurricane Harvey was a climate change wake-up call for Texans, but now its effects are being felt by everyone.
The crazy wildfires, the massive flooding, the increasing intensity of hurricanes. So I think people are seeing and feeling the impacts of climate change and realizing this is something deadly for humanity.
Shea believes the pandemic forced a real-time experiment on a grand scale to prove how well telecommuting could work to reduce fossil fuel consumption that contributes to climate change. According to Shea, Travis County government has saved more than $1 million on utility bills by allowing 75% of its workers to telecommute.
We've decreased greenhouse gas emissions from our employee commute by over 30%, and we've increased productivity, improved employee morale.
Shea adds the pandemic inadvertently illustrated how quickly environmental damage from carbon pollution can be reversed.
There were so many reports from India that people could finally see the night sky, and they'd never seen it before, and it was so beautiful and amazing because everybody wasn't driving all over and choking the air with fossil fuel emissions from their cars.
I'm Roz Brown reporting.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 1st, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Laura Smith. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Tramiel Gomes, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Tin Can Phone. At 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews Fanny Curtat about Beyond Van Gogh, the immersive experience, which opens at the Oregon Convention Center on November 19th. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be hearing a special rebroadcast of reporting on the People's Depot, a community-led, independent bottle redemption service that was born out of the pandemic. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hi, I'm Laura Smith, and what you hear is the sound of cans and bottles beginning to be collected at one of the People's Depot's sites here in Portland, Oregon.
The People's Depot is a community-led, independent bottle redemption service born out of the COVID-19 pandemic, when access to bottle redemption became limited and people were in critical need of income. Bottle and can deposits are a critical source of income for many members of our community to cover basic human needs, such as food, housing costs, bus passes,